Good afternoon. Let's call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect it is approximately 3:32 p.m. this Thursday, February 9th. We do have a quorum with us here today. Present Co-Chair Wagner, Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator French, and myself, Senator Pasquin. We expect to be joined soon by Senators McGuire and Wilikowski. Today, the Senate Resources Committee has one piece of legislation and one presentation. It is the goal of the committee to grant them approximately equal time to each one of those agendas so we can make sure that we have the opportunity to fully develop the piece of legislation and to hear the presentation. First, we will have Senator Thomas present Senate Bill 153. Its short title is Natural Gas Storage Tax Credit and Regulation. And we will hear from the bill sponsor and his staff, as well as invited testimony. It is my intent to hear and hold that bill today, giving the committee members and the public appropriate time to review the legislation and to offer this committee and its members feedback. We will also conduct public testimony at a later date on this Senate Bill 153. The committee is also hearing a presentation from Mr. Bradford Keithley, and he has prepared the presentation titled Judge Gleason's Decision, an Alternate Perspective. So we look forward to both the presentation of the Senator's legislation and to Mr. Keithley's presentation. Without any further delay, Senator, I should notice in the audience we have Senator Geisel. And Senator former there he is in the back, former Senator Terrio, and we have Senator Thomas with us here today. Please come forward regarding Senate Bill 153.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, Fairbanks, Alaska, the Interior. We appreciate the time and the opportunity to start the discussion on Senate Bill 153. As we have all heard, the cost of energy in much of Alaska are stifling, crippling the communities and their economies. The dramatic delivery of fuel oil to Nome helped focus our state's attention for the last month. However, things come and go, and now most people are moved on to other issues, but it's still the middle of winter in interior Alaska and the west coast and the northern part of the state. And more specifically, to my bill, anyhow, the in Fairbanks, we pay $4 a gallon for heating oil, thereabouts. We're spending approximately $666 million annually on energy costs. This averages out to approximately about $6,667 for every man, woman, and child annually. Much of this money leaves the community and does not circulate into local businesses. It's exported through companies that own distributorships or whatever in the interior. Fairbanks is currently paying $23.35 for 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas and 23 cents per kilowatt hour. And as I said, the price of a gallon of fuel hovering around $4 a gallon. Individual bills of $1,000 to $1,500 a month during the heating season, and that heating season can be described generally as September through April. It might be a little shorter depending on year to year, but that's roughly it. So you're talking about $6,000 to $8,000 out of the family pocketbook just for heating and electricity. Most of that for heating, and probably if we added the electricity a little more carefully, we'd find that we were certainly at the top end. Natural gas is, of course, the lowest cost fuel, but it's three times the price of gas in South Central and only available to approximately 1,100 customers because there is no more gas available for the local distributor, Fairbanks Natural Gas. They are just precluded from getting any more gas due to their contracts in Cook Inlet, which provide for Cook Inlet being taken care of, and the cities and towns there first because they have the original contract, so they only allow what overage might be available to be taken by Fairbanks Natural Gas. We have lines that have been built to various parts of the town in the Fairbanks interior, and specifically the city, that have not been able to be distributed because there is no gas contemplated to be available. We now have, through Senate Bill 153, we've begun to address this problem by incenting the private sector to deliver additional truck natural gas to Fairbanks in the next 2 to 3 years. SB 153 would extend up to $15 million of tax credits to a liquid natural gas trucking project, such as the one proposed by partnerships between Golden Valley Electric Association and Flint Hills Resources. This is the same $15 million tax credits, basically, that are applicable to Cook Inlet's gas storage project, which most of you are aware of, CINGSA. We are simply looking to receive the same benefit for our gas storage project as our neighbors to the south. Of course, we're talking about above-ground storage rather than filling depleted wells with which we don't have any around the Fairbanks area. A project like the gas trucking is not new, and we are cautiously optimistic that this will progress. We have been we've chosen language that allows for flexibility depending on what happens with the potential for this growth. We know that both Golden Valley, in conjunction with Flint Hills, are looking at it because they are the two largest tenants for gas in the interior. And it makes sense for them to buy that gas to make use of it, but they may also be willing to accept someone else as the deliverer of their gas. But we have limited this to regulated utilities, which is important, I think, for people to understand, so that that the credits available only for utilities will be passed through as the regulator of the RCA takes a look at their business plan. GVA and Flint Hills are still narrowing down their cost estimates, and once they get to a plus or minus 30% estimate, their board will make a decision when they go forward. We're expecting that this spring or summer they will make that decision and move forward. Actually, don't want to sound like they're moving away. If not, it is possible that an entity such as Fairbanks Natural Gas or NSTAR or their Canadian parent company AltGas might move on the project. They've indicated some interest as well, which we encourage all and any to get involved in the participation of getting gas to the interior, or more gas to the interior. Negotiations between Flint Hills and Golden Valley are still ongoing. Questions such as who will own which aspect of the project and who will purchase gas from who and various other points are still on the table, but it has been progressing rather favorably, and their most recent look at it as they evaluated was positive. This is another reason why the timing of SB 153 is so important. As these negotiations are ongoing, any knowledge of cost savings and what it will take to receive tax credits will affect how the project moves forward. Cost savings for SB 153, $15 million, or 50% of construction costs, whichever is less, will play a substantial role in ensuring that this project moves forward by cutting down the total cost that will have to be amortized by Golden Valley by the ratepayers. Anybody looking to take advantage of these tax credits must be a regulated utility, as I said, under the purview of RCA. This will guarantee that any use of state dollars on an LNG storage facility will result in a cost savings to the consumers. This will also ensure that North Slope producers or LNG export facilities that are not regulated utilities and do not provide for consumption of gas in state will not be able to access these credits. With the gas line still years away, it appears the only project that could bring gas into the interior in a very quick manner is trucking projects such as this one, or an expansion of the existing trucking project that already exists. We must find a bridge from today's crippling energy costs to a pipeline and a more permanent source of low-cost energy, and Senate Bill 153 will get us there. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I urge you to join me in support of Senate Bill 153 and bring some relief to interior Alaskans. I thank you, and my staff, Greer Hopkins, is here with a few additional comments and to answer any questions you might have, and there also are some people online, I believe. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Senate Bill 153 /I for discussion purposes.
Again, I'll object for discussion purposes, but Mr. Hopkins, if you would please go through the bill for us, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. My name is Greer Hopkins. I am a legislative aide to Senator Joe Thomas. I will be brief, Mr. Chairman. The reasons for introducing Senate Bill introducing Senate Bill 153, as Senator Thomas said, there's a fundamental difference between storing natural gas in its gaseous form and storing it in its liquid form. The volumes simply don't match up. The House Bill 280 was introduced with a floor of 500 million cubic feet in order for it to be able to access the tax credits that it put forward, which is excellent when you have access to the underground reservoirs, but when you don't, as Senator Thomas said in Fairbanks, we're looking at storing approximately, I believe it was about 240 million cubic feet of gas in two separate tanks during this facility. So if we were to apply the same volumetric equation to the storage of the liquid natural gas, it would come out to a little over $700,000 saved by the people of Fairbanks. So Senator Thomas wanted to try to find a way to apply that same $15 million to the Fairbanks project. So we looked at a $15 million cap, same as the Cook Inlet gas storage credits, with a 50% tax, 50% of construction costs applied to that number. We came up with that 50% construction cost because the estimated cost for building the storage facilities on this project are about $30 million, bringing us to approximately $15 million worth of credits that would extend to the ratepayers of Fairbanks. The changes between version M and version I, which was just adopted, are rather simple. As Senator Thomas said, the project is still up in the air, and we're not exactly sure how it's going to proceed, but we wanted to make sure that any project to bring gas to Fairbanks would receive those same credits. So the inclusion of language allowing for the expansion of an existing facility that was in business before 2010, or 2011 rather, was important because, as he said, Fairbanks Natural Gas or an Ensar or an Alta Gas might be able to come in and take over the project if it unfortunately falls by the wayside, but we're not hoping that happens. So the primary reason was to bring it to the GVEA and Flint Hills Pros project. It also removes the date restrictions that a facility must start commercial operations for that same reason. Anybody who takes advantage of the tax credits must be a regulated utility. House Bill 280 2 years ago did an excellent job of laying out that it must, any of these projects must pass along that tax credit and that benefit to the customers. So under 4205990, there's a new subsection that requires it to be a regulated utility that stores, if it stores gas and passes along that benefit to the customers for their public consumption, it must be regulated by the RCA. It currently does not say LNG, but we are working to make sure that that is included in that language also. As I said, Mr. Chairman, I would be brief, and those are my comments on the changes to the bill and the reasons that we implemented or introduced Senate Bill 153. I would be more than happy to walk through the project or through the bill or answer any questions that the committee members might have.
If you could just briefly go through the sectionals so that we identify to the committee members precisely what's in each.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Section 1 establishes that 1 million gallon threshold that the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission would look at to ensure that this project is eligible to receive these tax credits. That floor is put in place so that it would apply to a large enough project. The AOGCC must verify that it has that amount before it can begin applying for the credits. Section 2 begins addressing the lease exemption that was is also being enjoyed by the CINGSA project as it is being developed in Cook Inlet. It might be applied slightly differently to the North Slope, but GVEA has been in contact with the administration, and they understand how it's moving forward. But if there's specific questions on how GVEA or in Flint Hills is looking at it, applying that lease credit, I would like to defer those comments to Dan Britton, who's online as the CEO of GVEA for the specifics. I'm sorry, not Dan Britton. Thank you. Brian Newton. Sorry about that. Section 3 amends the definition of a natural gas storage facility under 4205990 to assure that tank storage or storage in a depleted or nearly depleted well can apply for this tax credit. That includes this project as opposed to just the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Association's project. Section 4 amends the existing tax storage facility credit by splitting out that tank storage versus the underground storage for these tax credit purposes, because they are applied slightly differently with the volumetric equation necessary for the underground storage, the 25% of construction cost application of that calculation versus the 50% up to $15 million for a 1 million gallon tank minimum for an LNG facility above ground. So it splits those two so that there's no confusion in the statute between those two applications. Section 5 amends the terms of what the storage qualifies as a tax credit by, again, adding that 1 million gallon threshold similar to Section 1 of the legislation. Section 6 and 7 adds payment to the language as opposed to just a tax refund. Golden Valley Electric Association is a nonprofit and therefore does not pay any taxes to the state. So in order to make it easier and clearer within statute, the legislative drafters wanted to add or payment in so that a nonprofit that pays no taxes would have access to the what could be called a tax credit. Section 8 sets forth how a company not subject under this tax chapter would still be liable for any payments that the state applies to that company and that project, but in error, so that the state could receive some of this money back if the organization stops commercial operation of the storage facility or if there was a calculation error in how much was given for the construction cost or for the 1 million gallons as determined by the AOGCC. And Section 9 amends 4320.046I in statute to clarify that a person that receives the payment under this title, the person would not be must repay the state as the interest determined under 4305.225. That's calculated if the erroneous payment was made, as I was saying before, they would still be liable, and that describes the interest payment that would be applied to that liability for the erroneous payment. Sections 10 through 13 make a number of conforming languages, especially including the word payment, going back to the nonprofit status of the Golden Valley Electric Association. And Section 14 establishes an effective date.
Any questions of the bill sponsor or his aide? Seeing none, thank you. We'll off-net. I believe we have Mayor Luke Hopkins from Fairbanks. Are you there?
Yes. Thank you. This is Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks, North Star Borough. On the record, Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity, and fellow committee members, Senator. This bill is very important for Fairbanks. You've heard it expressed by Senator Thomas and staff. I do say that this is an economic issue for our community. True, it's an incentive for a business model. Correct, it gives tax credits for increasing storage capacity, but in a basic fact, it is a benefit to those in our community. More people in our community will be able to take advantage of having increased gas supply. We are gas supply strained. We are the cost is also very high, as you've heard many times from around the state. Thank you for the opportunity for letting me speak about how it is here in Fairbanks. That economic issue is a concern. I see people lining up at the lowest outdoor gas pump that serves home heating oil, that pumps home heating oil. Cars are lined up there. People are buying it in 5 gallon cans because they probably can't wait. They may not have enough funds to make it to when the next truck can come by with the amount of discretionary money that they have. Obviously, you're aware of the northernmost urban community in the United States, the second largest community in Alaska, needs this benefit. It will be one of the fastest short-term improvements in our space heating condition that we can see. There's opportunities, as you heard, to set tanks very soon with the existing Fairbanks Natural Gas, the supplier of gas in our community. And then, of course, as you know, the trucking project that's being considered at this time between Golden Valley, Flint Hills. There's opportunities for tank storage in our other populated area, concentrated population in North Pole as the plan is progressing. Again, I ask that you move this bill forward as fast as possible, forward it on so that those in our community that could have more gas opportunities, more low-cost energy, clean burn because of our PM 2.5, that is what is needed to occur in this community. So I ask you to support this. Thank you very much, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions? Seeing none, we thank you, Mayor Hopkins. Also off net, Jim Dodson, Fairbanks Economic Development Council. And the record should also reflect we've been joined by Senator Stevens. Mr. Dodson.
This is Jim Dodson with Fairbanks Economic Development.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Resource Committee. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 153. This bill, as you know, would extend the existing tax credits to segments beyond Cook Inlet to include Fairbanks. That this is a crucial component to the Fairbanks infrastructure to allow us to move from our current staggering energy costs, which are mainly fueled by home heating fuel in the neighborhood of $4 a gallon, to a natural gas system. This energy cost in Fairbanks is devastating families, homes, businesses. It is making Fairbanks an economically non-successful community. I appreciate the testimony of Senator Thomas and back his statistics 100%. I won't repeat those. I just urge you to support this bill. It is crucial to the viability of the Fairbanks economy. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dodson. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move to Mr. Terrio. Would you... Okay, all right. Brian Newton, I understand you are at the Fairbanks Legislative Information Office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am. Good afternoon, and thank you. My name is Brian Newton. I'm the president and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association. Golden Valley serves roughly 44,000 residential and industrial customers and is the largest producer of electric power in interior Alaska. Our service territory covers Greater Fairbanks, North Pole area, extending down the Richardson Highway to Delta Junction and down to the Parks Highway to Cantwell. As you are aware, and as Senator Thomas and Mr. Dodson and Mayor Hopkins said, the cost of electricity is extremely high in Fairbanks. Over the last few years, this has been exacerbated by the high cost of oil. In 2011, oil accounted for 60% of our fuel bill, but produced only 36% of our power needs. Although we secure as much gas fire generation out of the Cook Inlet as possible, and we purchase and spend as much power from coal as we can, we still rely on oil for 35 to 40% of our yearly fuel needs. It's this segment of our local generation that has driven our cost of power so high. As a result, Golden Valley is aggressively pursuing ways to replace our oil fire generation with alternative sources of power. In anticipation that affordable natural gas would someday be available in the interior, we installed an LM6000, basically a 737 jet engine, at our North Pole expansion plant. This 60-megawatt unit is currently running on NAFTA, or Jet A, but it can be easily converted to natural gas. The legislation you are considering today may help determine whether such a conversion is economically feasible. Golden Valley watched with interest as the Cook Inlet Recovery Act was debated and passed in 2010. The legislation established an incentive for creation of a natural gas storage around the state to satisfy regional energy needs. At the time of its passage, Golden Valley was involved in the investigation of trucking LNG to Fairbanks from the North Slope. However, the trucking concept for a large volume of gas was not fully developed. Despite this fact, the Interior relied on statements that were made in the provisions of the legislation that were written to apply statewide and would hopefully accommodate the future needs of the Interior. As Golden Valley established a partnership with Flint Hills to advance the development of an LNG project, we reviewed the provisions of the gas storage incentive statutes and have determined that they need somewhat some slight modifications to be applicable to our proposed project. This is due to the fact that at the time that HB 280 was passed in 2010, the primary focus was on creating an incentive that would trigger the development of geologic storage in the Cook Inlet to handle seasonal peaks of natural gas demand. However, the legislation referenced both geologic below-ground storage and tank above-ground storage. Through SB 153, we are now asking that the provisions be clarified to allow a similar level of support for tank storage. As Senator Thomas and Mr. Hopkins has outlined, SB 153 proposes to create a level playing field for above-ground tank storage. Mr. Chairman, may I have another minute?
Please continue.
Great. Finally, I would like to stress that Golden Valley does not consider the establishment of an LNG trucking project from the North Slope as being in competition with a future pipeline. In fact, we believe bringing large volume of natural gas to the community via truck will allow local distribution and customer base to develop, thereby underpinning the economics of a future pipeline. Mr. Chairman, thank you again for taking this bill under consideration, and Golden Valley is prepared to work with you and the committee to make sure that natural gas incentives are available to the Interior as well as to other areas of the state. I or Gene Cario are available to respond to your questions that you are, that you or the committee members may have. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Newton? Seeing none, I would request that you submit the written testimony so that we can make that also as part of the official record of this Senate bill. Mr. Newton? Must have lost him. Doug Isaacson, please. Mayor of North Pole. Please state your name and affiliation, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Doug Isaacson. I'm the mayor of the city of North Pole, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of passage of this through the committee and ultimately through the floor. I won't repeat all of the other speakers. They've each brought up very important points that address both specifics and general reasons why this is very important to pass. I was wanting to speak instead to what natural gas will do to our communities like North Pole and such. You heard Mayor Hopkins mention that we have a need for clean air. You understand this need as well. North Pole has been rated the dirtiest air this winter, and that's largely because I think we also have the two refineries and Golden Valley's 180 megawatts of diesel powered electricity generation. So there's factors. Also, we have many wood stoves. You've also helped support the study for a build-out for distribution, and this all plays together, as Mr. Newton said. It makes the dynamics of a pipeline just that much more real. I want to address certain aspects, socio and economic. One of the fact is right now, as Senator Pasquin pointed out, very expensive fuel, very expensive electricity, very expensive gasoline, so that people are paying on average $1,500 for all three, space heating, electricity, and commuting to work each month during the winter. This is not sustainable. We can't afford it. We are in pain. And I get on my cell phone whenever an ambulance is dispatched, and I see a lot of personally inflicted wounds happening lately. And I hear the comments. There's a lot of pain. We're asking for solutions, immediate and long term. This is, as Senator Thomas said, a bridge. In our sense, a bridge from pain to plan. It shows people something credible is going to happen. If we can incentivize, if we can make sure that the costs are passed on to the consumer, that's all good. One of the aspects is we've been told that the handshake from the municipalities to the legislature looks like this. You know, gimme type of a handshake instead of, hey, how are you doing, Senator? We want to also mitigate that. This project will, because one of the aspects we're trying to do with economic development is attract a larger a store that will provide us with things that we cannot buy in North Pole. I can't get Fred Meyer's to look, several other, I won't mention all of the other stores that are possible that have contacted us, but over every single time, they're saying, you got great traffic flow. We've got 21,000 cars going through our city each day, and yet it's not attracting the usual suspects when it comes to retailers because space heating. If we can get natural gas, a storage tank that will allow us to distribute natural gas to space heaters, we will get more revenue. We will be able to do more for ourselves because we do charge four cents on the dollar, capped at $8, for retail sales tax. We'd love to build our reserves, and our choice is either increasing our taxes to build those reserves, which we can't afford right now because everything else is so expensive on the consumer and the resident, or increase our tax revenue, and that's the preferred. For this, many other reasons, I just speak in favor of this, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Seeing no questions for Mayor Isaacson, thank you very much. Mr. Terrio, I know Mr. Newton said that I don't know if anyone has any questions for I just want to make sure that the opportunity is theirs if you would like to. All right, Dan Britton, would you, are you off net?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, would you like
to, can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes. Please identify yourself, state your affiliation, and provide your testimony.
My name is Dan Britton. I am the president and CEO of Fairbanks Natural Gas. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and fellow committee members. In the interest of time, I won't go into the details of why we support the Senate bill, as they were have been well covered by others today. I'll just remain online in the event any questions come up. However, I urge you to support Senate Bill 153 for natural gas storage in the interior.
Seeing no questions, thank you very much, Mr. Britton. The committee, we do also have members from the Department of Revenue that are available. If anyone has questions, Matt Fonder, Lenny Dees, Joanna Bales, and Sheree Nienhaus are also available. If, I guess, given Senator Steadman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just as a, you know, this is our first crack at looking at this bill, but I'm not quite sure that this isn't a regular capital appropriation request being, you know, coined in the flavor of a piece of legislation. If I'm understanding the numbers correctly from the bill sponsor, that would be roughly a 50% reimbursement or credit against the construction of a storage tank, which is kind of similar to the conversations we've had dealing with hydros, Matana, other hydros around the state. If the state picks up, tries to help with 50% of the cost, get the cost down so the customers have or the citizens have a more reasonable source of energy. So my, you know, one of the concerns is initially is just the structure of this in a piece of legislation versus running it through the regular capital appropriation process. And as an example, we take the hydro issue through AEA and as an example. So there's some concerns there. And as we go forward and work on this piece of legislation, because it is substantially, I look at it as substantially different from, storage facility underground, a depleted gas storage area, and I'd be concerned if we started legislating appropriations, reimbursements on capital projects through legislation in general. I mean, if we put hydros in here, for example, I think there's other processes that we should go through to get our energy issues addressed, and clearly the concern is heard and throughout the legislature on the issue that Fairbanks face is faced with $4 oil and 23 cents a kilo, strangling the community. In effect, you know, I would surmise that it had some impact on the military's decision to move planes, cost of energy, cost of housing, the whole works. So, anyway, with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll work with the bill sponsor on some of my concerns as we move forward and look at this piece of legislation.
Mr. Stedman, thank you. Any other comments at this time? We thank the bill sponsor. We are going to, as I indicated earlier, set the bill aside for now. We will take that up soon, and we will now transition to Mr. Bradford Keithley's presentation. I think we're still on track. Brief at ease. Back on the record, and we do welcome Mr. Keithley. He's a well-respected member of the Alaska Bar and has been an active participant in issues for many years, and so welcome to the Senate Resources Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. For the record, my name is Bradford Keithley. I go by Brad, so please call me that. I am a partner and co-head of the oil and gas practice at Perkins Coie. For those of you who are not familiar with the firm, it's a firm of about 750 or so lawyers. The largest office is in Seattle. Anchorage was the first office established outside of Seattle in the 1970s. And there are now multiple offices. We have a DC office, Chicago office, Shanghai office, Hong Kong office. So it's a fairly large and Pacific Rim, if you will, oriented law firm. When you say well-respected, Mr. Chairman, you haven't read Dermot's column this afternoon, have you?
I haven't.
Dermot called me out by name in his column today, so we'll see how that goes. To give you some sense of my background so you know who's addressing you and the perspective I come from, I have practiced oil and gas law. I'm getting older, so for 35 years. I started out in the late 1970s with a regional law firm in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Congress was kind enough in 1978 to pass the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978, which launched my career. During my time there, I represented consumers. I represented the Oklahoma Fertilizer Manufacturers Association, which was roughly 30% of the consumption of Oklahoma gas at that point in time, as well as producers. I represent small producers there, and I have subsequently in my career as well. From that firm, I was there 6 years. From that firm, I became senior vice president and general counsel of what was at the time a Fortune 500 utility, still is, though under a different name. The name of the company was Arkla. It was an integrated utility. It had production, a major production arm, pipelines, and distribution companies. It was headquartered in Little Rock, Arkansas, and served a five-state area, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and Kansas. And I learned a substantial amount of many things during that period. My boss was a guy by the name of Mac McClarty, who some of you may recall was Bill Clinton's first chief of staff. It's because he was the only one who could get along with Bill and Hillary at the same time. And McClarty, my exposure to McClarty and my exposure to Clinton during that period deepened my understanding of politics to a point that it's somewhat much greater than it was prior to that point. After that, I became partner and subsequently co-head of the oil and gas practice at a law firm called Jones Day. Jones Day is roughly 2,500 lawyers spread throughout the globe. The oil and gas practice was centered in Dallas and Houston, where I was located, but we also had lawyers in Washington, New York, London, Moscow, Sydney, Australia, Hong Kong, Beijing, and L.A. And that practice was a global practice and gave me the opportunity during that period, frankly, to understand a lot more about the global oil and gas industry than I had to that point. To that point, I'd largely been engaged in regional oil and gas issues. During that time, in the early 1990s, I started working Alaska issues, and in 1993, in fact. And over the course of the next several years, I gradually went from a point where I was coming up to Alaska once a quarter, plus or minus, to handle issues, to a point where I was up here once a week. And for the last 5 years, I was up here roughly three and a half weeks a month. I went home to went back to Dallas to make sure my house hadn't burnt down during that time. During that period, I've gained a substantial amount of understanding of Alaska issues. And I finally decided to move up here 4 years ago permanently, having lived in the Residence Inn for a long period of time. I finally decided to move my practice and move my my body up to Anchorage and join Perkins Coie, and have been the co-chair of the oil and gas practice since that point in time.
At this time, if I could interject briefly, the record should reflect that we've been joined by Senator Wilikowski and Senator McGuire. Welcome to so please continue.
Thank you. I will note on the slide deck that I did this yesterday, and I'm not quite sure why I put August 9th. 2012 is the date. Maybe it was wishful thinking that maybe it would be warmer if I put August, but that's a mistake, and it should be February 9th, of course. I do want to point out that the opinions I'm expressing here are entirely my own. I'm not speaking on behalf of any client. This is at my own expense, on my own time. It's not sponsored by any client, and it's simply because I think these issues are significantly important to the state, and I want to make sure that I help the state get these right, and I think it's important that that the perspective that we take on this case and on others be one that sort of understands, puts them in context, if you will, as opposed to sort of reacting to them on the moment. As Mr. Brenna pointed out yesterday, I understand, I was not involved in the case as representing a party, but I monitored the case closely, and I've studied the decision closely because of its potential impact on Alaska. I, like all of you on this committee, are concerned about the future of Alaska, and I think that it's important to study these issues, to understand these issues, and I've spent a substantial amount of time reviewing the record, the public record in the case, and reviewing Judge Gleason's decision to get a better understanding of it. I'm not here to challenge or dispute the logic or conclusion of the opinion. This isn't a case where I'm going to say the judge was wrong on XYZ. I'm concerned much more about the context that we give this case and the understanding we have of this case than I am about the interstices of the case. So I'm not here to dispute Mr. Brennan's review of what the case stands for, or I'm not here to dispute the judge's decision on various facts. I'm here to make sure that we fully understand the context that we're giving to this case. So with that, I'm going to briefly talk about the background of the case. Mr. Brenna gave you a much deeper understanding of the background. I'll just hit the highlights, talk about what the decision says briefly, and then what the decision doesn't say, because I think that's the important aspect of one of the important aspects of this, of understanding this case and the significance of it to the state. And then I'll talk about the implications both of the case and of other factors for the future. As all of you know, the case involves a state court dispute over the valuation of TAPs for property tax purposes. I've heard some people say that that the judge had no business talking about property tax, talking about oil and gas issues. I completely understand why she did. I have the highest degree of respect for Judge Gleason. Judge Gleason is a jurist who has stood up for things that I think are important. She is, after all, the judge who decided the Point Thompson case and decided that DNR had made mistakes, reversed it once, and DNR came back, reversed it twice, and that decision certainly on appeal. But Judge Gleason is someone that I have a great deal of respect for. So for people to say that this is a decision by a judge and shouldn't be, you know, weighed in policy considerations, I think is just wrong. This is a good judge, and she's made what I think is a very thorough analysis of the record. The parties were obviously Alyeska on one side, the pipeline, the North Slope Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, and Valdez, and the Alaska Department of Revenue on the other side. That has some significance that I'll come back toward the end of the presentation. The life of TAPs, the judge's determination on the life of TAPs is relevant to TAPs economic value and the accumulated depreciation. She had every right to be weighing in on these decisions and evaluating the evidence on these decisions, and she had to reach a decision with respect to the economic life. I mean, this is a case about the value of TAPs, and if TAPs were going to close down tomorrow, it'd have one value, and if TAPs is going to close down a number of years from now, it's going to have an entirely different value, and so she has to take that into account, as well as the level of depreciation, the period over which depreciation is going to be calculated. So life of TAPs was something that was entirely relevant and entirely important to the decision. I will say the decision is subject to appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. There's already an appeal of her last decision regarding valuation on appeal. I assume that this one will be appealed as well. And so it's another reason it's not appropriate to get into the interstices of the case. I'm not going to try to second-guess what the parties are going to say on the appeal. What the decision does say, Judge Gleason found that the value of TAPs for property tax purposes was $8.94 billion in 2007, $9.64 billion in 2008, and $9.24 billion in 2009. In the course of determining those values, she concluded that the life of TAPS, based on its proven reserves and incorporating its minimum capacity throughput limitations as of 2007, 8, and 9, is at least, the life of TAPS is at least until 2065. And she found that based upon weighing the evidence and evaluating the material that was in front of her, and also based on her conclusion that TAPS can continue to accommodate flows as low as 70,000 barrels a day. I think she used 100,000 barrels a day as the mechanical limitation in deciding that it's 2065, but found that the evidence supported going deeper.
I mean, just to be more precise, that wasn't solely her conclusion regarding 70,000. That was a BP study that reached that conclusion. Isn't that more precise way to say that?
Well, I think 2065 was in the BP study that she took as having evidentiary value, and I'm not sure what the volumes were that were in the study associated with that, but she did use 2065.
And I'm referring to the 70,000 barrels per day. I believe that was the Carpenter 2010 and the Larkspur.
There certainly was evidence in the record relating to 70,000 barrels a day.
Senator French.
Just on that same point, thank you, Brad, Mr. Keithley, nice to see you.
See you, Senator.
That bullet point jumped out at me as well, the 70,000. We've spent a lot of time with the opinion as well. I'm on page 150 of the decision. Paragraph 438, where the judge says, for the foregoing reasons and after careful consideration of all the evidence presented at trial, the court finds it more likely than not the taps can effectively transport throughputs down, at least down to a minimum flow rate of 100,000. So, you know, I know she discussed the 70,000, but I don't know that it's fair to say that her conclusion was the taps can continue to accommodate flows as low as 70. I got 100,000 out of the judge's paperwork.
You know, I wouldn't argue about 70 versus 100, Senator. Basically, her decision is it can go for a long time, and I don't disagree with that. Thank you. Thank you. Now, this is what I think is important that the committee and others keep in mind when considering the decision. There are things the decision doesn't say. The decision doesn't say anything about current or reasonably foreseeable production levels. The decision simply says that the production tail, that is the length of time that there will be production, will continue longer than I think others have previously alleged. The decision doesn't go into any discussion of current production levels or reasonably. I'll probably lean back up to it, so just shout at me next time. Or it doesn't go into anything about current production levels or the forecasts of future production levels, the level of production as opposed to the length of production. It simply says the production tail will continue longer. The decision also doesn't say anything about the effect of declining production on the state's economic well-being. It doesn't speak to the level of state revenue. It doesn't speak to how well off the state's going to be or not well off the state's going to be with respect to any different production with respect to any production levels. It simply talks about in the part that's relevant to the discussions that we have had. It's simply relevant to the length of time that there's going to be production, and I think that's a critically important factor to keep in mind as we consider the issues about this. I don't often agree with Joe Balash, but I do in this regard. Joe said that Joe had it right in an article that Becky wrote regarding the decision. Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Joe Balash said that a 300,000 barrel a day throughput scenario, a 300,000 barrel a day scenario, not to mention the 100,000 or the 70,000. Later on, a 300,000 a day barrel throughput scenario would be a disaster. And from an economic standpoint, as I will discuss here in a moment, Joe's exactly right, and I think it's very important that we keep that in mind as we talk about what this decision says and what this decision doesn't say. The reason for Dermot's column today, I think, was my next bullet, which was a paraphrase from James Carville from the 1992 presidential campaign. The reason I put that in there, Carville was a great influence on my life. As I said, part of the time I was part of my prior career, I was in Arkansas and I was working with McLarty and working with Clinton, and I was around the war room in 1992. And the war room for the Clinton campaign in 1992. And Carville had a tough time getting Clinton's attention. Clinton is a brilliant, just a brilliant individual. But it's hard to get his attention because he's usually convinced that he's right about things, and it's really hard to just wake him up. So Carville finally just started calling him stupid when he wanted Clinton to get a point. He said, "You know, it's the economy, stupid." And Clinton, to his credit, would wake up when Carville would use a phrase like that. So, my only purpose, notwithstanding Dermot's column, my only purpose in using this phrase is I think this is one of those points where we need to wake up and focus on what's really important here, what's critical here. And in Alaska, it's the production rate that's important to our economy over the next two decades at any given point in time, given our dependence on oil. Not the reserve life. It's the production rate that's important. So let me talk about that. Sure.
I guess everybody has, you know, different views of the world, but clearly there's been a lot of discussion since late last spring around the state that the pipelines and getting to the point within maybe a decade, a little less or a little longer, then it's going to be shut down and removed because of the lack of oil. That's why we're having this hearing, in my opinion. So to put to rest that we have billions of barrels of proven reserves as we sit here today, and we have billions and billions behind that number into the future in other areas, if it's shale, if it's heavy oil, if it's offshore potential, and that the directional change that would be required if the state to make, if we were to have a higher probability of losing it, the TAPS line and closing in that basin, we would have to take a fairly immediate directional change in the legislature to prepare the state for the upcoming economic turmoil in front of it. And we at the Finance Committee asked the Revenue Commissioner that very question a week ago, if we should be turning 90 degrees and addressing that issue, and his answer was no. And there is no imminent demise and stranding of our basin that the public has a perception that there actually, you know, that there is. So we're spending a lot of time going through these documents, talking about that to put that issue to rest. And I see in your presentation you're going to walk into budget issues, and I'll address those as we go through, because I'm not really interested in scaring the public. But we'll walk through the presentation, and I'll ask the chairman to let me speak up a couple of times, because we've spent a lot of time dealing with steering the state of Alaska out of the financial ditch, and we're going to continue to do so. So anyway, just for those watching at home, I don't want them to get the impression that the whole discussion here is we're wondering if the line could run at 100,000 barrels or 70,000 barrels, because frankly, we can't operate at that amount at the state of Alaska, and we're not going there anyway. So we'll worry about the financial, I guess, part of the presentation when we get there, but just so the folks at home know that our basin is not going to be stranded, it's not going to be shut in, and we're going to, you know, put some of these things to rest so we can get to the subject matter at hand, and that's our tax structure.
Senator, I appreciate that, and I think I agree with you on the point that the discussion around TAPS shutting down, I think, was a diversion. Not that anybody intentionally diverted, but I think it put us on a discussion that path that frankly was a dead end, and not one that was very productive. I do think, on the other hand, based upon the information that's out there, that we are there is a need to move in the very near term with respect to increasing investment and increasing production in the state because of the consequences and the lack of production. So I don't think the motivation, I don't think the correct motivation for acting is that TAPS is going to shut down, because I think the judge's opinion is correct on the fact that the 300,000 barrel a day limitation is one that can be overcome with investment. But I don't think that means that there's not cause for concern. I think there is cause for concern in terms of the effect of the continued decline in production.
Just on that,
Senator French has a question.
Just sure. On that point, I think Senator Sedman said it well, and it just bears repeating that some of the pressure that we've felt in the public arena, not so much from experts, but in the public arena, is that the threat of a pipeline shutdown is being used to extract a tax concession. And as evidence on that point, I pointed to a headline that you can find even today on the Make Alaska Competitive website. If you go into their End of the News columns, there's a news report that says, producers tell Alaska to become competitive or pipeline will be in jeopardy. And I think for many people in the public, they're very, very, they begin to believe that unless we lower oil taxes, the pipeline's going to shut down. And so that's something that these hearings were designed to break, and so that we could have a dispassionate, economic-based analysis of what we get out of a reduced oil tax without having the threat of, you know, cutting the jugular vein of the state hanging over our heads during that debate.
Well, I think it is fair, Senator, to say to recognize that substantial additional investments are going to be required to keep the pipeline operational. I think Judge Gleason's decision, it goes to the point that it is possible to make those investments and keep the pipeline operational, but I think it's fair to say that there have to be substantial additional investments in order to keep the pipeline operational. And in order for those investments to be made, I think there needs to be, you know, an economic rationale for the investment to be made. So I think that entire debate about whether or not TAPS is going to come to an end is a side road that it is nice to have as maybe maybe not even nice. So it's a theoretical discussion, but it doesn't go to the central point of what's important to the state, and I think what's important to the state is the production level.
Just as a finer point, it's not a substantial amount of investment to keep the, you know, the pipeline in operation relative to the amount of revenue. Like this year, we're going to be arguing over a split of $14 billion in one calendar year or fiscal year, and we're going to adjust those, and that number might move a little bit. The discussion or the capital expenditures is for, you know, enhanced oil recovery and additional volume. It's not the operation of that line. In the consequence of things, it's not that expensive.
Well, but it's not cheap either, Senator, to make the investments necessary to put the heaters in, to make the investments necessary to adjust the operations of the line to accommodate lower flow along the way is not a cheap proposition.
Without, you know, drawing too fine a line to it, because I don't, you know, we don't have, neither one of us have the numerics in front of us, but we're talking about billions in profit oil under discussion on the split. That's what the point of indigestion is. And if you have $3 billion in capital costs and you got, you know, $2.5 billion in operating costs and your gross stock is $20 billion, I think you got enough room to buy a couple of heaters if they're several hundred million dollars.
Okay.
In 1 year.
Okay. And Judge Gleason found that the economics would justify that. The decisions still have to be made to make that investment. The companies still have to make the decisions to make the investment, and they still have to look at the economics of it. The judge, I will grant you that Judge Gleason found that those investments would be made.
You know, would you agree that the value of just the proven reserves alone is probably the greatest it's been in the history of oil when you look at the proven reserves that we have now relative to ANS price at $110? I think it's almost $120 today.
I've not looked at that number, Senator. I mean, so what you're telling me is I take the amount of reserves times the current and projected price and compare that to the amount of reserves times the then realized price in the past, and I haven't done that analysis.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Brad, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Good to see you.
A couple things that came out of the Brenna testimony that I thought were important. One was a document presented by it was a BP document written in 2004. It's titled Restricted. And it says Alaska's role in BP's portfolio is to provide a stable production base and cash flow to fuel growth elsewhere in the business. We know that BP shut down their exploration, hasn't explored in years in Alaska. Exxon hadn't explored for years in Alaska. I guess they're doing some in Point Thompson now, if you consider that exploration. Conoco hasn't explored. The testimony has been from a number of the majors that even if we pass HB 110, they still don't plan to explore. So it just seems to me that I guess I'm just curious to hear your response to that. We've got producers who are saying for years we're not exploring in Alaska. So why would we give them a tax break now to promote something which they've been saying for years they're not going to do, and even now are saying we're still not going to do?
Well, Senator, in 2006, BP testified to that particular point, and the testimony was basically this. We've got more potential opportunity sitting in Prudhoe, Milne, and Kuparik than we think reasonably you can find by going out and exploring what the industry calls ram acreage outside of the existing basins. We have more potential by identifying and investing the additional oil that's in those fields than we have by going out and exploring. And if you look at the numbers, well, at least the numbers that were there in 2006, and I don't think they've changed significantly since, the estimates of what there is remaining in the existing units is substantial. And I think the focus of the companies has been let's develop the technology, or let's see if we can develop the technology to get at those resources that sit in the existing units.
Just follow up, yeah, on that point, and you, I'm sure you've seen this. This is probably going to be hard for you to see, but this is a chart that was produced during the trial, and it shows the decline curve on the North Slope, and then it shows it flattening out for probably 8 or so years, and then it's spiking upward significantly. And this is not anything that's prepared by the state. This was prepared by the United States Department of Energy, showing that even without tax breaks, we're seeing production levels of 1 million barrels a day within a decade.
Hey, Senator, did you actually go back and read the DOE report that comes from?
I've actually read prior reports that this came from.
No. Did you read the report this came from?
This was presented by Robin Brenna, so I have not read the specific report that this came from, but I have read prior reports that
okay.
This came from.
This particular, I was intrigued by this slide also, actually, to tell you the truth. This particular slide comes from a section, it's a 2009 report. The title of the report is Alaska North Slope Oil and Gas, A Promising Future or an Area of Decline. It's prepared by DOE in April 2009. And this slide comes from a portion of that report that's titled Undiscovered ANS Oil and Gas Forecasts. And what this slide is composed of is adding the undiscovered, estimated, but undiscovered gas reserves that some people have estimated exist on the North Slope to the undiscovered, estimated, but undiscovered oil reserves that some people have estimated as of that point in time existing on the North Slope, and coming up with what the report itself says is an ideal scenario if all of the assumptions in the report were fulfilled. I don't think that kind of estimate or that kind of projection is the kind of numbers that the state of Alaska ought to be predicating its policies on. That's sort of like going down to Vegas and assuming that you're going to run the tables and that you'll come home a rich man. It's not the kind of numbers that have been looked at. I mean, they're undiscovered, so they're not even the kind of numbers you can look at and say that they have reality.
Well, I that may be going a little too far, because isn't it in all basins around the world that you have a limited definition of proven reserves? There's some under development. There's some that are undiscovered because, that is pretty standard technology. USGS just issued, with respect to Cook Inlet, approximately a year ago, the undiscovered potential at 19 TCF. So that terminology is not unique to Alaska. In other words, if I could move on, I guess respectfully I request, have you, we're talking about the Central North Slope region. Have you performed an economic analysis as to present value of the economic stream that will be coming down from the Central North Slope?
As a lawyer, no, and nobody should trust it if I did.
I'm just wanting to know what your support is.
Support for what, Senator?
Your position.
Well, the support for the position is that the production rates are what are critical to Alaska's future. And the support for that is, frankly, comes straight out of the Alaska government reports that have been issued by the governor's office and others. In particular, the Office of Management and Budget 10-year plan that was recently published in connection with fiscal year 2013 and forward. In scenario three, the governor's fiscal year 2013 budget, assuming a 4% annual growth, annual general fund expenditure growth, and assuming oil prices that are in the report, showed that at current production rates, we hit going underwater. That is, we hit a point where revenues don't match expenses, or revenues are below expenses in fiscal year 2016. And that we stay in that position then from 2016 onward through 2022.
Mr. Chairman, can I have a request, please? Can we let Mr. Bradford Keithley get through his presentation? We're about 20 minutes from the end, and he's literally made it through 10 slides. We allowed the other two gentlemen 2 days in the courtesy of at least getting through those. He's been under cross-examination now for at least 30 minutes. Please, I'd like to hear his presentation.
I think he was presenting, Senator.
Well, he was trying. That's for sure.
I do have questions on his presentation. I wouldn't want to looking through these slides, leave the public with the impression that the Finance Committee is not aware of this stuff and it's not already in the process of taking action to deal with some of this forthcoming issues.
Certainly there's a balance.
Right.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to go back to my central point, my central point is that Judge Gleason's opinion or decision doesn't reach these issues. Judge Gleason's decision talks about how long the production life is going to be, but it's not talking about production levels. And looking at the scenario three in the OMB report, we're already hitting these issues in 2015. That's with fairly rich oil prices. The backup to that slide shows that we assume $108 in fiscal year 2012, extending up to $120 in fiscal year 22, and yet we'll, even with these fairly aggressive oil prices, we're hitting a deficit. The red begins in fiscal year 16 under the line budget surplus and shortfall and shows that we're starting to shortfall in terms of general fund revenues compared with expenses by 2016. That's not in terms of assessing the risks that the state faces. OMB also did a report that relied on $90 oil, and using the same analysis but using $90 oil from 2012 forward, they showed that we hit a deficit as early as next year, 2013, and it continues after that point. Now, you know better than I that when we hit a deficit, what's going to happen is that we're going to start drawing down on the statutory budget reserve and on the constitutional budget reserve as our backups to funding state expenditures. But this report shows that, addresses that, and shows that at $90 a barrel, not only, if you look at the line that is budget surplus and shortfall, not only do we go in the red beginning in 2013, the two budget reserves, which are on the lines below that, the constitutional budget reserve and the statutory budget reserve, are drawn down to the point that we go to zero on both budget reserves by the year 2021. At that point, we have no budget reserves remaining, and we're in a situation where we don't know where the revenues are going to come from to continue to finance state spending going forward.
Senator Stedman has a question.
It's nice, and we look at these things, it's nice to have these type of projections. And I know we're short of time, but I am concerned that we don't ring fire alarms just to ring fire alarms. If we go back in time a few years when I first got here, we're every year at Finance, we were continually delivered a chart showing that we're going to run out of the CBR, our Constitutional Budget Reserve, and we're going to be fit back into the permanent fund within a handful of years. And every year that gets changed and pushed out and manipulated. And as time has walked on, we still have that same chart delivered to us every year. Now it's out substantially into the future. But with that being said, as far as when the CBR is going to run out of money, CBR isn't running out of money. We've fully paid it back, and we're increasing reserves. When you have a situation where you have a budget shortfall, you don't continue to allow your operating account to grow at 4% or 6% or some number, and you don't drive the car off the road until you run out of cash, and you can't make your payroll. So I mean, it's just not going to happen. A year ago, 2 years ago, when we had a sharp decline in oil, we cut $500 million immediately out of the capital budget, the finance table. Just rolled it right out. And we had a fairly quick spike back up in revenue, and we picked up those expenditures the following year. So we look at these type of trends, and we have this, you know, we're the ones, the legislature put it in to require the governor's office to do a 10-year plan so we can try to get everything on the table and look into the future and see what some of the outlooks are and then deviate around them. One of which is the biggest impact, one thing that's one of the biggest impacts on these charts is our unfunded pension liability of $11 billion. We currently have legislation in the committee working
point of order to deviate
with that.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. We're going clear off the point of the presentation right now. I understand what Senator Stebbins is saying, but I don't see how that really reflects back on what the presentation we're supposed to be receiving today means. I mean, we can sit and listen about budget all year, but that isn't why he came here to present this.
I believe the slide does raise that, and I assume the senator.
I could sum up real quick.
Thank you.
Just to say to the public, these numbers aren't going to happen. You know, we're not going to be that derelict in our duty to allow the state to fall off a financial cliff immediately in a few years with our eyes closed. It's just ridiculous. We don't operate like that. And we have work in process every year to ensure that the state moves forward financially.
Senator, Senator Stebbins, through the chair, I greatly appreciate that. And one of the things that we need to do, the state needs to do to address that, is to address the production levels. One of the things that drives the need to cut expenses, the need to address, to cut things out of the budget, is fallen in production levels. And the fall that we're having in production levels and what that's doing to revenue levels is significant. And I don't want us to be, you don't want us to be, none of us want it to be, a situation where we have to address that by starting to cut the budget and starting to cut significant things out of the budget. The much better way to address that is through doing things to address production levels and get production levels up. My point here is Judge Gleason's decision doesn't say anything about these issues. It doesn't say anything about current production levels. And to assume that we're in okay shape because Judge Gleason says we may go to 2065 is the wrong assumption to make about it. We're in a difficult situation in the next decade and certainly the decades that follow that because of the drop in production levels, regardless of how long the life in TAPS is.
Senator Wilkowski, question.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we all agree we all want more production, different philosophies on how to do it. Do you feel comfortable sharing your ideas on how we can increase production?
No. Senator Wagner is going to call me out of order if I do that, because that's going to take me entirely out of the presentation range. I'd be happy to come back and talk about Norway at a point of time convenient to the committee, because I do think that plays a significant role in addressing production levels. And I think it's an important thing for this state to consider, but it's not germane to this presentation, and I don't want to incur Senator Wagner's wrath, much less the chairman's wrath.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the point with respect to the $90 a barrel scenario is the fact that, as Senator Stebbins puts it, we will have to do things to address the fact of significant revenue drops beginning as early as next year. And if we didn't do those things, if we didn't address expenditures, we would be out of both the statutory and the constitutional budget reserve by as early as 2021. And frankly, as we sit in this room with oil hovering around $100 a barrel, it seems that we're fairly comfortable. But my hands went cold over the weekend when I was catching up on my current reading and saw this headline and then read the Shell presentation. Shell, not a small company, is seeing lows of $70 a barrel in 2012 volatility, $70 a barrel oil. The presentation says that they're looking at oil levels in the range of $50 to $90 a barrel over the course of the year. And as with most ranges, the midpoint is what they feel most comfortable about. Well, the mid-range of that is $70 a barrel. And when you look at the consequences to us, Mr. Chairman, of the $90 case, and how quickly we go into a deficit and how quickly we start running through the statutory and the constitutional budget reserves at $90 a barrel, that becomes a substantially even greater concern when you talk about the potential of going to $70 oil. I'll be brief through this. There is another perspective on this in addition to the OMB reserve. Last year, Scott Goldsmith of UAA's ICER Institute did what I think is probably one of the most important papers that's been done on the fiscal policy in this state in a long time. It's titled Webnote 9. And what Scott did was take the 10-year budget forecast last year and extrapolate it on out for another 10 years. His point was we were sort of masking the effect on ourselves of only looking at a 10-year cycle and not looking at the where we were headed longer term. This first slide takes the last year's OMB report, which frankly was much more much rosier than the current report, and projected it on out. The black line on the left-hand side is an estimate of 6% expenditure growth over the course of time, and Scott did that from extrapolating history, notwithstanding the fact that people said they wanted lower growth. He extrapolated out what had happened in the history. The green on the left-hand side is revenues from existing, well, it was the projected revenues from the budget forecast. The blue is what some had estimated in terms of gas revenues. And the yellow was the draw from the statutory and then the constitutional budget reserves in order to match the expenditure line. And as you can see, as we got past 2018, this is last year's OMB forecast, as we got past 2018, we were beginning to draw on the statutory and the constitutional budget reserve. On the right-hand side, the blue bubble is the amount, the gross amount of the statutory and constitutional budget reserves. The yellow bars are the contributions to or the withdrawals from the statutory budget reserve, the statutory and constitutional budget reserves, and it shows that in the early years there were still contributions, which matches on the left-hand side the fact that there were revenues above the black line. And then in the later years it's showing drawdown on the statutory and constitutional budget reserves, and it shows that we hit, that we fully drew down both reserves by 2032 based upon the expenditure levels that Scott did in the analysis. He then did an analysis based on no gas, because one can be skeptical about the future of gas revenues from time to time, and he took out gas. Again, the green, again, is the revenue levels that were estimated in that budget. The yellow is the constitutional, the statutory budget reserve. You'll see that along about 2028, there's white space with neither green nor yellow in it, and that is what Scott put as the twilight zone. There's no revenues under current provisions to match up against the expenditure line that's out there. That's the drop in the revenues that the state suffers. The right, again, the blue bubble is the status of the statutory and constitutional budget reserves over time, again showing in 2028. And this is a case, frankly, that looks a lot like, this is a case that Scott did last year, assuming oil prices were 75% of the then forecasted oil prices. This is a case that frankly looks a lot like the $90 a barrel case that's in this year's OMB report. It shows revenues dropping below expenditures as early as next year. It shows beginning to draw down on the statutory and constitutional budget reserves next year. You'll notice on the right-hand side there's no contribution because we're running deficits as early as next year. There's no contribution to the CBR and the SBR. And so the amount of the CBR and SBR is much less. The drawdown, we run out of the reserves. We run out of the ability to match the revenue line by 2022, and we go into Scott's twilight zone from there on out into the future. There's a couple of other consequences of the TAPS decision, of Judge Gleason's decision, that I think are worth mentioning, because it's sort of the law of unintended consequences. We need to sort of factor through what this is going to do. First, the decision by increasing property taxes increases TAPS rates. If we're concerned about the level of TAPS rates, and the level that is being charged for transportation, this decision actually increases those rates. Roughly 25% of the current TAPS rates are to recover ad valorem taxes. This decision will increase that amount roughly up to about a third, up to 33% of current TAPS rates will be to recover property taxes from the recover ad valorem taxes. Increased taxes certainly mean increased rates, and if the concern is that we want lower TAPS rates, this decision is sending us in the wrong direction by increasing costs. The second, the decision disproportionately benefits three boroughs, North Slope Borough, Fairbanks, and Valdez, and hurts the state. The increased TAPS rates reduce royalty and production taxes. Taxes. The TAPS rates are a deduction off of the calculation of netback. Royalty and production taxes are based on netback. Increased TAPS rates means lower netback. It means lower royalty and production rates. So the state as a whole will have lower production tax and royalty revenues as a result of the decision. There is an offsetting benefit to those three boroughs who receive the benefit of the decision's ability to increase property taxes, but that will come at the detriment of the state in terms of decreased royalty and production tax levels. And then, finally, it's a significant additional tax hike on industry and reinforces the perception of unpredictable, litigious Alaska business environment. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, the point that I want to leave you with is that Judge Gleason's decision is a decision that I'm not arguing with. It's a decision I take at face value. It's a decision that looks well reasoned. It comes from a judge that I highly respect. And it's a judge that I think if you ask the members of the bar, they highly respect. They certainly recommended her highly for her recent appointment to the federal bench, and the Senate, the United States Senate, confirmed her. A rare action with respect to judges sometimes. And I don't argue with her decision, but it says nothing about the decline curve that Alaska is on, the production rate decline curve that Alaska is on. And to me, that is the most important factor that we have to take into account in this state, because it's what drives state revenue levels and it's what drives the economic well-being of the state. At most, the decision merely says the tail end of the decline curve may be extended longer than some have previously forecast. It will go longer than the 2030 that some have talked about, and I don't dispute that. It may go to 2065. It may go even longer than that. But that's not the important point. What that essentially says is the person that's here at the end, and I'll try to be here, but given my age, I'm not sure I'll be the one. The person that's here at the end gets to stay a few years longer before they turn the lights off on the Alaska economy, but the remainder of us will have long since left before, because the state will be significantly underwater. That's my presentation, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Just briefly, just in conclusion, I guess, so people take some of the presentation on the finances here with a grain of salt, which is, I think, what they should. The rating agencies, you're probably well aware, have AAA rated the state of Alaska.
Yes, sir.
In an economic time, and most of the states are going backwards financially. I would be very surprised if we're on the edge of a financial abyss and the S&P turned around and gave us AAA rating. We spent several years working our finances and working the goal to get our ratings upgraded. So Alaska is one of the most solvent states in the Union, and we will have our choice, our challenges today and into the future to continue staying on that course. But we're one of the strongest states in the Union, and I can assure you that the rating agencies look at our future expectations, or the future expectations of the financial position of the state, before they upgraded us.
Senator French, did you have a question? Or
just a comment. I have some questions about one of the backup slides that Mr. Keithley prepared. I know we're out of time. I've got a 5 o'clock appointment. If you can swing by my office, you're spending the night here in Juneau, wonderful Juneau, I understand.
I am. I'm missing a basketball game because.
Sorry about that. Sorry about the basketball game. But do you have any time? Do you have any time? We all have loved ones and other things in our lives that may not be right here in this room. If you have some time tomorrow, I'd love to talk to you about them.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, yes. we appreciate your missing the basketball game, coming and meeting with us very much.
Mr. Keithley.
I know it's a sacrifice.
Yeah, Mr. Keithley, I do, on behalf of the Senate Resources Committee, thank you for presenting. And it is part of the record now, and thank you very much for that. Given that the Senate Resources Committee is adjourned for this Thursday.